Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. The message that came from Washington to the troops in Western Europe was very clear. Quote, hostilities will cease on the whole front at 11 hours today, French time. Until that hour, the operations previously ordered will be pressed with vigor. At 11 hours, our line will halt in place and no man will move one step forward or backward. End quote. Those are the orders released just before 9 o'clock a.m. on November 11th, 1918. So 90 years ago today. That war came to an end insofar as the war did end on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of the year 1918. We look back and we understand that the end of World War I reset the entire globe and set the 20th century towards a world of incredible war and mayhem and murder on a scale heretofore never even imagined within humanity. This is Veterans Day in the United States of America. At least it has been for the better part of the last seven decades. It is indeed November the 11th, 2008. And today we're going to be talking about veterans. We're going to be talking about war. We're going to be talking about the debt we owe to those who have put their lives on the line. This is not Memorial Day. And in the background to this are always the ones who are honored on Memorial Day, those who have died in battle, in war. But we're talking today about those who have survived, the veterans who are still alive among us, including veterans of most of the wars of the 20th century. We'll be talking about what we should be thinking about on this day, how we should think about war on Veterans Day. And, you know, one of the interesting things in the backdrop to this is the fact that the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan turned out not to be major factors in voting for the 2008 presidential election. That in itself is very interesting. We'll be talking today about what that matters. I want you to call. I'd especially like to hear from veterans and from friends and family of veterans, from those who have been thinking about this war and about its meaning and about our particular responsibility as Christians and as a church, both to veterans and to those who are the families of those right now fighting in the armed conflicts with which this nation is involved, wearing the uniform of this nation. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, we'll look at some other issues in the news at my website at albertmohler.com. I published an article this morning entitled The Challenge We Face, and it is a new challenge. It's reshaped on the issue of same-sex marriage by what took place just over the last week, as indeed the state of California, the state of Arizona, the state of Florida passed constitutional amendments banning same-sex marriage, establishing marriage as the union of a man and a woman. Yesterday on this program, we looked at the changing landscape and what that means. I wrote about it at albertmohler.com. You can find my article published this morning. Time Magazine is out with a very interesting article. Reporter Michael Lindenberger. The title is, headline, After the Gay Marriage Debate, Activists Rethink Tactics. He interviewed me. And that material, including his interview with me, is found in the article at Time Magazine, also available at time.com. We'll put a link up to that in terms of the website today. If you cannot find it there at Time, I'd suggest you go look at it. It's very interesting. There'll be a lot for us to look at in this as we look back at this issue and as it unfolds before us. One of the big issues on the ballot on November the 4th was something that hasn't gotten much attention, and that is the issue of euthanasia or assisted suicide in the state of Washington. The state of Oregon, just to its south, had of course been the state that heretofore been the only American state to officially, by plebiscite, by referendum, pass a law legalizing assisted suicide. Now we've seen now over the last decade or so what this meant for the state of Oregon. Let me tell you one of the big things we've learned. We learned that even though this is always pressed as a way of allowing persons who are terminally ill to end their suffering, it always turns out that a large number of those who end up being assisted in suicide aren't terminally ill at all, nor is any such claim even made of them. We'll be seeing what happens in Washington now that that state has adopted similar legislation. The New York Times is out with an article today suggesting that even as the landscape is evolving on the issue of same-sex marriage, it is for assisted suicide as well. One of the interesting things about this article by Jane Gross is that it gets to the very heart of the issue, which is medical ethics. And it suggests that medical ethicists are split over these issues. It's going to be very, very interesting to see what happens. But Dr. Timothy E. Quill, director of the palliative care program at the University of Rochester, you've probably seen his name on end-of-life issues coverage before. He suggests that the public's mind is changing on this toward greater acceptance of assisted suicide and euthanasia. That may be true. Dr. Quill has recommended, according to this New York Times article, that a palliative care consultation be mandatory before anyone should go towards the issue of assisted suicide, because it just might be that there can be an alleviation of their pain by another means. One of the things that Dr. Quill points out, by the way, is that palliative care, palliative meaning here, care that relieves pain, that this is now a new board-certified subspecialty in medicine. And that tells you something about how things have developed along lines that do not lead to assisted suicide, but instead lead to the alleviation of human suffering by means of medication and other medical technologies. We'll be watching this with you, but let me tell you right now, the issue is front and center in Great Britain, and it is so in a way that we really need to look at. And let me just tell you the story here, because I've been hearing about Hannah Jones for the last several days in the British and English media. Here's where it comes down. Hannah Jones is 13. When she was 12, she had already suffered from a rare form of leukemia for 7 years. She had gone through incredible cycles of medical treatment. A lot of the medical treatment that was used was at least able to extend her life, but at the cost of injuring her heart, a hole has developed in this girl's heart. When she was 12 years old, she was presented with the news that she would have to have a heart transplant if her life were to be prolonged. She did not want to have the heart transplant after all that she had already gone through. And as I understand her case, this was not going to extend her life towards a normal lifespan, but rather to give her some expectation of prolonging her life for some time. It turns out that Hannah Jones did not want this surgery. She said she didn't want the surgery. She communicated that herself and through her parents. But in recent months, one of these hospitals that has a review board there in the United Kingdom decided that it would try to take custody of Hannah from her parents in order to mandate that she would have the surgery. She and her family appealed. They won the appeal. She is not going to have the surgery. The Guardian, which is the most left-wing of the major British newspapers, has major coverage of this. It tells us that she is indeed dying, that her family is outraged, that the hospital sought to intervene in her case. Let me just read to you from the article. It says, Hannah Jones, age 13, decided against the surgery, saying she wanted to die with dignity, surrounded by family and friends. But her local hospital, Hereford Hospital, instigated high court proceedings to remove her temporarily from her parents' custody to allow the transplant. End quote. Now, here is something that we ought to really note with care. We are opposed as Christians on the basis of the dignity and the sanctity of every single human life, and on the basis of the fact that we are not God. We are opposed to both euthanasia and assisted suicide. But we need to recognize that being opposed to euthanasia and assisted suicide does not mean that we believe it is medically necessary that every single patient avail himself or herself of every single treatment in a hope of extending the life by whatever amount. In other words, we do not believe that we're able to stave off natural death. We do not believe that natural death is an accident, but rather that it is a part of God's design. It's a part of the curse of sin. It's a part of human reality. We are not trying to beat death by medical technology. And if we were, we would simply be fooling ourselves. But we are seeking to be responsible stewards of the gift of medical treatments and medical technology, and to be responsible stewards of the gift of life. Therefore, it is not our right to end it prematurely. It is not our right to decide when someone shall die by assisted suicide. But it may be legitimate to allow persons to say, I've had enough medical treatment. I'm not going to have any more. That can be an individual's determination. You know, that's easier to understand when it's an elderly person in the hospital after repeated illnesses who simply says, I am not wanting any more. It's harder to take and harder to understand in the case of a 12-year-old girl who's just turned 13, who is going to die without this treatment. But she may very well die with it as well. She's had enough. And there's a sense in which her desire there is to be honored. That is not euthanasia. That is not assisted suicide. That is simply responsible medical treatment. Folks, these are difficult issues. They're difficult for everyone. They're difficult for families. They're difficult for hospitals and medical personnel. They're difficult for for pastors and ministers who show up at the bedside and are often asked for specific help in dealing with these questions. But here is the reality. These are unavoidable questions because these issues will touch every single family. If not yours yet, then soon, and soon enough. We are living in a time of incredible medical advances, medical technologies of extended life, enhanced life, but the reality is that death is still the final enemy, humanly speaking, and no medical technology has been able to stave that off. It does come. We'll be back to talk about death on the battlefield, veterans who survived the war. On Veterans Day, our responsibility to those who put their lives on the line. We'll be right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Very interesting words heard there. This is the song, of course, Over There, written by George M. Cohan. And by the way, Cohan received the U.S. Congressional Medal of Honor some years later for his patriotic music. That was music written about World War I. And Veterans Day, originally known as Armistice Day, of course, ties us back to World War I. The first Armistice Day was proclaimed by President Woodrow Wilson. It was proclaimed for November the 12th of 1919. So a year and a day after the armistice was signed and took effect, Armistice Day was declared in the United States to honor the veterans of World War I. Originally, this holiday did not honor all veterans, but only the veterans of the First World War. On June the 4th, 1926, Congress passed a concurrent resolution that was to change the date from November the 12th to November the 11th, because that was the date that hostilities were ceased by the armistice. An act approved in 1938 made the 11th of November each year a legal holiday. It was known as Armistice Day. And then beginning in about 1953, Armistice Day was changed to Veterans Day in order to honor the veterans of all wars. That, of course, meant after World War II, and you can understand why. Millions of veterans had come back after World War II. Instead of adding another day, they went back to November the 11th. And this is one of the biggest historical markers in Western civilization. People do not often think about this. But the end of World War I came not with a bang, but with a whimper, and it didn't come really with an end. That was the big problem. Historians looking back at the 20th century remind us that we really should not talk about two great world wars, but rather one awful, tragic world war interrupted by a false and temporary peace, at least a cessation of hostilities. You know, World War I did not end like World War II ended. In World War II, Germany and Japan surrendered. The Axis powers surrendered. In World War I, there was no surrender. Instead, harsh terms were forced upon the Germans there on a train in France at Versailles through the treaty. And what came down there, Versailles, the treaty, of course, came after the armistice, but the armistice itself was simply a cessation of hostilities. It was not, and I repeat, not a surrender statement. Even the Treaty of Versailles did not require surrender. It instead required the surrender of territory, the Central Powers as they were known, especially what had been Germany-Prussia, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Ottoman Empire were all stripped of territory, but it was a false peace. As a matter of fact, it set up the terms of World War II. And when we look back at it, we realize now World War I completely reshaped Western culture. Why do I say that? It is because before World War I, all of the nations of Europe, every single one of them, you could almost trace it down to individual national histories. All of the major nations of Europe were ruled by grandchildren of Queen Victoria. They were all, at least in terms of how their monarchies were established, they were all the kind of nation that is not even now conceivable in Western Europe. you had the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And, of course, that was the originating spark that led to the development of World War I with the assassination of Franz Ferdinand, the Archduke, that was the heir successor to the last of the Habsburg emperors there. You had the Austro-Hungarian Empire that spread throughout most of what is now Central and Eastern Europe. Then you had the unification of Germany late in the 19th century that set up Prussia to be this militaristic state. You had Kaiser Wilhelm II, who was himself a grandson of Queen Victoria, who would become the great evil symbol, indeed, of World War I. Then, of course, you had in Russia another great empire. You had yet another who was himself a descendant of Queen Victoria, Nicholas II, the Tsar of all the Russias, as he was known. By the time you get to the end of World War I, you've had the Russian Revolution, no Tsar in Russia. You have had the end of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It breaks up, no emperor, no empire. You have the breakup of Germany. There's the abdication of Wilhelm II, who goes to Belgium in exile. And you have the reset of the entire European continent, but not to good. It did not lead to peace. Instead, it set up war. And one of the sad things about World War I, the originating war of Veterans Day, as we now observe it, one of the saddest things about it is that it began with an artificial optimism. You heard the song over there, that George M. Cohan song, and it just speaks of the kind of optimism of young men going to war without understanding how horrible war is going to be. And by the time Americans got to that war in 1917, they should have known better. Listen to the words of Over There. Johnny, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun. Take it on the run, on the run, on the run. Hear them calling you and me, every son of liberty. Hurry right away, no delay, go today. Make your daddy glad to have had such a lad. Tell your sweetheart not to pine, to be proud her boy's in line. Johnny, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun. Johnny, show the Hun who's a son of a gun. Hoist the flag and let her fly. Yankee Doodle, do or die. Pack your little kit. Show your grit. Do your bit. Yankee to the ranks. From the towns and the tanks. Make your mother proud of you. Make your mother proud of you and the old red, white, and blue. And then the chorus, over there, over there, over there. Send the word to beware. We'll be over. We're coming over. And we won't come back till it's over, over there. Well, they did come back when it was over, over there. But they came back after experiencing what, in the terms of military warfare and the history of war, was a war of unprecedented murder, genocide, and brutality. The Western Front, spreading almost 500 miles throughout Western Europe, was a place where the Central Powers and the Allies faced off in a war of attrition and what must really be called a genocidal, murderous mayhem. In the mud of France, millions died. You know, one of the most interesting things is the impact this had upon certain nations, not so much the United States, but Europe, and in particular, the nation of Britain. Britain lost more fathers in World War I than at any point in its national history. Nothing, including the plague, took as many fathers as did World War I. An entire generation was wiped out. The universities of Cambridge and Oxford basically graduated the best and brightest, as they were known, of Great Britain and sent them off to war where they died. And it changed the demography of Great Britain. It changed British culture simply because of all of that. At the end of World War I, there grew a tradition of British war poetry that is still as moving as it was back then. You have some of the poets really writing about what had been the demise of their dreams. As young men, they had gone to a war they thought might be over in a matter of weeks. As a matter of fact, many of these young, well-educated British lads were afraid that the war would be over before they would have a chance to fight. As it turned out, it wasn't over until millions of them had died. Now here we are, in the year 2008, 90 years after the armistice was signed, here we are with over 25 million Americans now living as veterans of various wars. Let me ask you, how do you talk about this with your children? How do you explain to them why it is so important that some be willing to serve so bravely for the rest of us? How do you explain the morality of war? How do you explain this in a time when there is no apparent enemy at our gates? That's part of the problem. If we are in a peace, it is a false peace. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Back with your calls on the Albert Mueller Program. We'll be right back.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. This isn't just a history lesson today. I'd really appreciate a conversation if any of you are really moved to call about how you think we should commemorate Veterans Day in the year 2008. What has changed in terms of our knowledge, our culture, our experience since 1918? 90 years later, should we look at this in a different light? You know, there are now millions of additional veterans. That's why they had to change the very title and context of the holiday. The observance was originally simply for the veterans who survived World War I, but by 1953, there were millions home who had survived World War II. They made it into one holiday. Since then, we've had the Korean conflict, the Vietnam War, two wars in the Persian Gulf and in the Middle East, and an ongoing war on terror. Just a lot of stuff there when you start thinking about what all of this means, not just in terms of American history, but in terms of living memory. There are millions, about 25 million, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, who have been Americans in uniform in past wars and conflicts. That's a lot. That's slightly less than 10% of the United States population. If you line up all Americans, slightly fewer than 1 out of every 10 would have served in uniform in the United States Armed Forces. That is a huge indebtedness. And when you start thinking about Veterans Day, it's like Memorial Day, a reminder of the 4th of July, that even as freedom is very expensive, it isn't enough just to mark it with one day a year or 3 or 4 days a year in which you try to make it a special memory. It ought to be a part of the ongoing conversation of a grateful nation. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. How do you talk about these things? One of the interesting things that I have had sent to me just in recent days in anticipation of Veterans Day 2008 was an article written by a dad who said, I'm not sure exactly how to talk about these things with my own kids. And I think this is a good time because it used to be easier in the sense that in Veterans Day observances, there would often be veterans who might be fathers, uncles, grandfathers, and others who would simply tell the stories. And now it's pretty much up to the History Channel. It's pretty much up to documentaries. This is a living history, and around us are the living survivors of these wars, the veterans of these conflicts. I mentioned the kind of poetry that came in the aftermath of World War I. You have poems like How to Die by Siegfried Sassoon. It's just really, really sad stuff when you look at this that reminds us of the awful brutality of war. The false idea of human progress, of the fact that human beings were getting morally better and better, died in World War I. Western culture was being driven by this myth, but it was destroyed by World War I. This poem, How to Die by Siegfried Sassoon, reminds us of that. Dark clouds are smoldering into red. While down the crater's morning burns, the dying soldier lifts his head to watch the glory that returns. He lifts his fingers toward the skies where holy brightness breaks in flame, radiance reflected in his eyes and on his lips a whispered name. That's the horror of war there. Wilfred Owen, perhaps the best known now of the war poems, the war poets of World War I. He died indeed in World War I. He wrote Anthem for a Doomed Youth. Just very, very sad. What candles may be held to speed them all, not in the hands of boys, but in their eyes, shall shine the holy glimmers of goodbyes, the pallor of girls' brows shall be their pall, their flowers the tenderness of silent minds, and each slow dusk a drawing down of blinds. You know, there are people alive today who saw the horror of war. They are the veterans who are the walking wounded, wounded by their experience of observing these things, and we are indebted to them. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. I believe it was General Lee, Robert E. Lee, who said before a major battle that it is a good thing that war is so horrible, otherwise we would love it too much. The phone number is 877-893-8255. We've got some callers on the line. We're going to get to your calls right after this break. Hang with me here. Because this ought to be the kind of conversation that grateful people have. And if anything, Christians need to understand, we're the people who know that indebtedness requires some articulation, some voice, of thankfulness. I wonder how many veterans today are going through the day with no notice, with no thank you, with no observance, no parade, no trumpets, no medals. This is an opportunity for us to remember an indebtedness that is not only a matter of historical remembrance, as important as that is, but it's a matter of our moral accountability as well. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
That was the song sung by British troops. So we had Over There, and now from the British troops, it's a long way to Tipperary. And they went to that war believing that it would be short and glorious. It turned out to be long and murderous, which is just a reminder to us of how awful war is and how seldom those who champion it, those who are the aggressors, those who attack other nations, actually get what they want. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Sandy calling from Orlando, Florida, listening on WHIM. What are you thinking about, Sandy?
Well, you know, it reminded me, Dr. Mueller, and first of all, thank you for your show. I listen to it every day.
Thank you.
When I was a kid, my dad was in the military, and he had been in World War II, and we were stationed in France and for a little while in Germany. And I remember at 8, 9 years old, I saw buildings that were all broken and you know, just rubble. And I remembered, and I asked my dad, you know, why were the buildings broken? And he told me because there had been a war. And that really affected me very, very profoundly as a kid. And I've been very patriotic all my life because I really, that touched me.
Well, I guess it would. You know, what an experience for a child your age to actually see that kind of ruin. My son Christopher and I were watching The World at War, that classic documentary about World War II last night, and one of the episodes begins with looking at this French village that was completely destroyed and has been left as a ruin. And I appreciate the sweet words about your father, Sandy. I think that's just another reminder that there are those around us and those who have gone before us who paid an incredible price. And it's really, really important that we not only honor them. Honor is something that's important and morally obligatory, but also that we thank them, because I think that is the deeper moral imperative here. Sandy, thank you for your call. Let's go to Falcon, Colorado. Mary's on the line. Go ahead, Mary.
Hi, I'm a retired master sergeant. I spent 22 years in the Army. I'm a Vietnam vet along with my husband who spent 22 years. I think the thing that bothers me most of all is that on Veterans Day, you have the furniture store sales and the clothes sales. It's not about sales, and if it is, it should only be for the vets. It should not be for everybody else.
You know, that's a very interesting comment, Mary, because it is interesting how commercialized everything becomes. I think we as Christians often note that, especially with Christmas and other things, where everything's turned into a commercial opportunity. And in a free market economy driven by this kind of consumer pressure, I guess that's just kind of to be expected. But, you know, you really do take it back to its ground level here, where you say it should be a day about honoring our military. And it is just often turning out to be something very different. By the way, Memorial Day, too, that's another Furniture Day sale, traditionally on the business calendar. But you make a very good point. Mary, you may not hear this from others, maybe not from your neighborhood, maybe not even from your neighbors and your friends who might not think of it today, but take it from me. And for many who are listening to this program right now, thank you to you and your husband and to so many others who served nobly in our armed services, because the reality is We have the luxury of having the conversation we're having on the program right now. We have the luxury of access to these airwaves and of conversation as free Americans because somebody paid the price. And, you know, when you look back even at World War One, it is amazing, just simply breathtakingly amazing how out of touch America was with the rest of the world in 1914. We thought we could avoid this. We as a nation really believed that these things are happening a long, long way away. When Franz Ferdinand, the Archduke, was assassinated in Sarajevo in 1914, we thought that was a long way and it couldn't touch us. When the Central Powers and the Allies went to war, we thought it was a war we could watch and read about in the newspapers. But of course, at the end of the day, it was only in 1917 that America had to enter the war, and we entered the war, let us be reminded, most precisely because Kaiser Wilhelm II ordered his navy to sink all vessels, all ships in the Atlantic that might have anything to do with conveying goods and services to his enemy nations. And thus, American ships were sunk, American lives were lost, and President Woodrow Wilson, who had promised not to take the nation into war, ended up taking this nation very much into war, into what became known as the First World War. And then you would think that that would have been a moral and historical wake-up call for America, but it really wasn't. We did not learn what others learned in World War II. But even those in the continent of Europe and in Great Britain learned lessons that turned out not to have been learned well enough. The seeds were already sown for an even greater conflict, and the cataclysm of World War II emerged from the ruins of World War I. The unanswered questions left unanswered at the end of World War I were answered conclusively and horribly and horrifyingly in World War II. You know, then you just fast forward and you realize here we are again. And by the way, in World War II, America again thought that it could avoid the war. Franklin Delano Roosevelt ran on a platform of not taking America to war. But by the middle of the 20th century, it was already apparent we were living in a globalized world where there was no way to avoid being drawn into a war of that scale. And now I think it's safe to say most of us are not tempted by that kind of isolationism. We really do care because we watch. And we watch because we care what's going on all over the world. But we also suffer the illusion of safety. We have succumbed to the illusion of safety. And even as a record number right now of Americans post-World War II and post-Vietnam are in uniform and are on long, sometimes, periods of deployment, and even as right now there are soldiers, sailors, there are men and women in uniform in all branches of the armed services serving nobly, some of them serving beyond their allotted time of service, all of them potentially, if not in actuality, serving in harm's way. We need to remember that a debt remains to be paid. And it's not just a debt of gratitude, it's also a debt of service. Right now, we're talking not only about those who are the survivors and the veterans of various armed conflicts, we better have on our minds and hearts and in our prayers those who right now are in harm's way. The morality of war is a horrifyingly difficult question. But the necessity of armed conflict at times is pressed upon a nation. And then the question is whether or not it will answer that call in such a way as to defend basic liberties and rights and the dignity and sanctity of human life itself. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. It's Veterans Day 2008, and you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We are thinking in historical terms today, and I have to tell you, I'm thinking about Frank Woodruff Buckles. He is a man who reportedly is now living in Charlestown, West Virginia. He is the last United States veteran of World War I. He enlisted when he was 16 years old. He served in the United States Army 1st Fort Riley Casual Detachment. He served overseas during World War I, and he would now be, according to this, 107 years old. When Mr. Buckles passes away, there will be no living veteran in terms of United States uniform from World War I. There are approximately right now something like a couple of dozen of those who are World War I veterans across the globe, and some of them are as old as 114 years old. You start looking at this and you realize that's a long time ago. A whole lot has happened from 1914 or from 1918 to the present. We're now 90 years away from the armistice on the 11th day of the 11th month, indeed in the 11th hour of that day in the year 1918. We can now look back with hindsight and see what did and didn't happen in the aftermath of World War I. Peace did not come. This was not a peace for our time, as was declared later, on the very brink of World War II. This was not the opening of a new era, as President Wilson was confident it was. This was humans tinkering with the lives of millions of other humans, murderously so. And it set up resentments, and it set up political tensions that led to World War II. And World War II was not, after all, the war to end all wars any more than was World War I. We find ourselves right now in a world at war. You know, as Christians, we're the people who understand why. I think it's very, very important that we come back to the fact that a Christian looking at this says, this is not evidence of international tension. This is evidence of sin. Human beings turn murderous. And we see the evidence of this in war. Does that mean that all war is wrong? No, a defensive war, a war that is fought on the right terms, Christians have come to understand as a just war. Pacifism, in terms of an unwillingness to defend, turns out to be not a good plan. And it does not preserve the sanctity and dignity of human life. Folks, we are living in a time in which it is just too expensive and dangerous to live with illusions. Stripped of those illusions, we need to be thankful to those who are now and have been on the front line to battle, those who have defended liberty for all of us. So to all, a happy Veterans Day 2008. Parents, tell your children the stories. I'll meet you tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Miller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.